Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of our program, Dare to be Different. It's just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming, Mediumwave 1548 Satellite Islam, and to those of you on the DSTV bouquet 826. And we've had a bit of a long break, and we're back spiritually rejuvenated, inshallah. And this morning we're going to be chatting on lots and lots of things. And normally at this time of the year, people are taking it quite easy, not wanting to go out in the garden and saying, well, it's not time for gardening. But really, if you look at trends internationally and locally, you find that may have been in bygone days. There's so much to be doing in the garden this particular time of the year, and there's lots of that you could, and perhaps if not anything else, you could be sitting down and planning and deciding what is to be done in your garden for the coming season. Talking about the coming season, we just got about 7.5 weeks before we go into spring, so that's sort of a long period of time. And to all of you that are out curled up perhaps in bed around the breakfast table, we'd like to join our conversation this morning. The number to 854-1548, Mohammed waiting to take on your calls. And we've got a wonderful guest with us this morning, and that's no stranger to Radio Islam. That's Andrea. Andrea, as we know, comes from one of the most beautiful parts of the world, but has been devastated by fire, and she can tell us some of that. And we're not too sure what's happening with the weather patterns in that part of the world. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. And like I said, you know, one's being in that most beautiful part of the world, but we've had the fire that devastated the Nizna. Tell us something about that.
Well, you know, I haven't even been to Nizna to look. I think I will cry. That fantastic cliff there towards Belvedere. I mean, it looked like a dragon breathing fire from the images that I've seen. It's really, I think the forests are going to take a very, very long time to recover, possibly hundreds of years. A lot of the indigenous forests also burned. It's really a tragedy. It's huge. There's been a lot of damage. There has really been. And it's still extremely dry, terribly dry. And, I'm becoming more and more aware of it. As I look at the indigenous plants that are adapted to the area that are really struggling with the drought as the water tables drop. Occasionally you'll find pockets of things that are still green. And I think they're sort of finding groundwater somewhere. But you're seeing a lot of dieback on trees and things like that, because they've got to beyond the point where a leaf economy works for them. Now, a leaf economy is basically, you know, where a tree, because I can't support my body anymore, so I need to shed biomass. And normally they begin by dropping leaves. But if that process continues beyond that, then the tree has to cut back even further. It has to reduce what it has to support even more. And then you start getting dieback. And I'm seeing that everywhere. Of course, with the dieback, even more dry wood. We've had a lot of bergwind conditions. Fortunately, not with strong winds, but with that heat and that dryness in the air. And there have been a couple of other outbreaks of fire just last week. Luckily, there's a place called Toes Runton. They were up there with helicopters and so on. Fortunately, no homes burned down this time. Largely, I think, due to the wind. And also because around that little village there is a bit more cleared area, there's not as much forest that could potentially jump into the residential area, the fire. So, yeah, it's still kind of a bit of a nail biter here. We're waiting for what we locally call the Sievedarian, that week of rain. We expect to have it around about this time of year. We have not as yet had it. And I think that's what we really need. There's still a lot of places smoldering. When you drive around here, you will see little columns of smoke rising. It looks like the fire department has decided that these areas fire are relatively stagnant, and they're just sort of keeping an eye on things. And they're difficult to reach, so they would be costly. I mean, they're going to have to go in there with helicopters and so on to bomb the fire. So, yes, in places where the forest is very nicely closed, the forest canopy, it's not that bad. Because forests actually protect themselves from fire. There's very little undergrowth in the deep forest because it's dark. And then also there is very little air circulation moving through. It blocks the wind. So the wind can't chase it through. But now as soon as we as mankind go and create a clearing, we spoil that. So for example, putting a road through a forest immediately makes it vulnerable because now you've got air movement coming through there. So yeah, there are still fortunately unburned areas of forest for which I'm extremely thankful because, of course, this part of the world very well known for its fabulous Afro-Montane forest, really beautiful scenes with majestic trees and the gorgeous little stream running through the mountains and the river valley. So I'm glad to say that some of that is still preserved.
You know, talking about the fire, and we're talking about, you know, still not yet over, you know, in the area that you were living, how badly has that been devastated?
Well, we have lost houses. There have been houses burnt quite near my home. I live out of the village itself. It's not all that isolated, but it's definitely not in the village. I have a weird address. It consists of a long number. But yes, on the Hoekville Road going up to Hoekville, there's a sort of wooded cliff there, and there were some people there that had wooden houses. I'm afraid those have been completely devastated. In Isle itself, I've heard of entire tourist developments that have been burned down, and of course, many people who lost their homes, also the poorest of the poor, in some of the squatter camp areas and whatever, that lost everything that they had. And I can only say that I see that a lot of South Africa has really rallied around really helping families in need at this time, and that is inspiring, but it's still very, very sad.
You know, while we're talking about the fire and so forth, and you spoke about waiting for the sea of diarrhea, and that's a 7-day rain, is water restrictions still in place?
Very much so. It really is so incredibly dry. We have to be very careful what we do with our water at the moment. And we're waiting for the rains. I see the rains have hit Cape Town this morning. I'm not sure how long they will be or how heavy they will be, but we will hope for the best. Yes, so we're basically just waiting. It is now July, so often we get a lot of our rain in August. I'm really hoping we're still going to get a lot of rain. And of course, a good balance, not enough to cause floods.
Yeah, but I think we definitely need the, you know, like you said, there's still smoldering fires, so you need that rain to come down and to douse all of those fires. I think that's important. Now, just going back to something that always piques my interest is the fynbos. You know, normally we need the fire to rejuvenate many of the fynbos species, for example, the proteas, the ericas, and so forth. Is that in danger, or doesn't it happen in that part of the world?
Look, we do also have fynbos. Fynbos is actually quite extensive. A lot of people think of it as being, you know, only the Cape Town area. It actually goes quite far. There's fynbos-type vegetation, even in places like Bosland. So, yes, fynbos is actually quite more widespread than most people realize, especially in mountainous environments. The problem with burning and fynbos is that it's not meant to burn too often. I've heard of authorities, and I do stand corrected if I'm mistaken here, let's say, you know, not more than once every 7 years or so. And I think the fires in certain areas are becoming more frequent than that. And at that point, you start losing species because it's just too much. It's not what they want. And of course, fortunately, we do also have a lot of sort of fire-wise plants, not so much of the fynbos, but there are fynbos companions that fall into the fire-wise category. And there are ways that you can garden to help keep fire down. Not this particular time, but a last time that I had a burn down the valley in which I live, there was a bird wing behind it. I, with my own eyes, saw pine trees actually exploding. They scream first as the resin boils, and then they actually shatter and explode. It was phenomenal. I was supposed to evacuate, and I was naughty. I didn't. I stayed behind, and I wet everything, and I down the breath test and so on. But it made me very aware because we actually had to fight. The firefighters were busy with our neighbors who have a wooden home, so very active. And on the other side, the neighbors on the other side had very open dunes, and the fire was raging there. So they were fighting on either side of me, but not on my property. And fortunately, I have a large milkwood forest behind my house. And the milkwoods, love them or hate them, are extremely fire tolerant. With this wind and this extremely hot fire, there was even a pine tree that fell down behind the milkwood forest, and was actually, the flames were licking against the leaves of this milkwood. The leaves didn't even turn brown for the first couple of days after that, but they didn't catch fire. It was really phenomenal how the milkwood stopped it. And then on the two sides of my property, which were not shielded by these trees. And typically, a fire-wise tree will have a low canopy. It will have quite rubbery, leathery foliage, quite possibly a milky latex that indicates wetness, which also helps to promote firewise. And then, of course, all the succulents have got so much moisture inside them that, you know, you'll get these huge things coming in. And then as they hit the patch of succulents, they die down. They still sort of stick through there, but flames are much lower. And they're really just burning the, you know, the dead foliage that's underneath. And they're not really burning the sappy part. So there it becomes very, very easy to fight and control the fire because the flames are now not very high. And, I mean, fighting fires, if you're fighting, there's points where it really would be very unsafe for an ordinary person to try and fight fires with beaters and whatnot. But when you've got low flames like that and not too much smoke, and we did have sort of wet towels wrapped around our faces, then the flames actually lick low the minute it hits these succulent patches. Things like the aloes, the copper brooches, and of course any other succulent because it's holding that much water in its foliage. Resins, on the other hand, as you can imagine, we were talking about the pine trees. You get these resinous plants, it's usually got quite a strong aroma. I'm thinking here with the indigenous, I'm thinking more of, for example, the Thai bush, the roost species, which I've seen in some literature being listed as firewise, but I strongly don't recommend them. Because the resin in there, when they do catch, they're slow to catch. But when they catch, they go up like a torch. And then they smolder for a long time after. It's very difficult to get the heat out of them once they actually do catch. So, yeah, I really realized the value of succulents to slow and stop fires. And I've basically been doing quite a lot of it around the periphery of my property, bearing in mind that I am rural. So, you know, I've got bush behind me. And if a bushfire happens, I'm, you know, in the line of fire, literally. So I'm planting quite a lot of this. And I am keeping basically fire breaks clear and planting them with succulents, particularly the copper brooches or sour figs. A beautiful plant. They're very fast-growing. They've got big, tiny flowers. They've got edible fruits. I never use them, but some people make jam and so on out of them. I just find them so useful, and they give me that sense of security because I've seen it with my own eyes, how they slow the fires. And the aloes too, you know, the skirt of dead leaves will burn, but it will take a long time before the aloe catches. And they survive, you know, the fire burns over them, and they don't die. Quite phenomenal to see, and it was quite terrifying.
Yes, I would think so. And Andrea, just tell us about the weather on your side of the world. So I've been waiting for the 7-day rain. Is it, you know, unusually hotter, unusually colder? Because on our side, we haven't had the intensity of the cold yet. We haven't had the black frost. It's been, you know, while the temperatures do dip in the evenings, early mornings, we still have, you know, in the upper teens going up into the early 20s. So that's what we have. I'm not sure about your side of the world.
Yeah, it's been quite mild. You know, we normally expect to see snow normally only in about August. That'll be snow on the mountains. Sometimes it does fall earlier, but it hasn't happened this year. It hasn't been abnormally hot, but then we have these weird weather swings in this part of the world. We have the Berg wind, which occurs when you have the low pressure area right on the coast and a high pressure on the mountains. Then that air is forced downward. Now, as everybody knows, when air heats up, it rises. But when air falls, the temperature rises as well. So you basically get this air being superheated. I think somebody gave me a figure once of, you know, how many meters descent it takes for it to actually heat up when it's coming down the mountains like that. And it's about a degree or not sure how many meters, so I'm not going to lie. But basically it's a superheated wind. And this, of course, is adding to our woes with the fire problem. And it was responsible for the reason why it was so difficult to combat the initial fire, the big disaster, because definitely on the first couple of days, there were incredibly strong winds. So they couldn't get the helicopters out, and they couldn't bomb the fires with water, especially in the remoter areas. A lot of farms burned down. But yeah, this bird wind thing is gives us very hot weather and makes everybody very irritable. and we've had that, you know, but we have it on and off. It'll be for 3 or 4 days, and then it'll be cold again. So yeah, it's pretty normal for the time of year, except for the dryness. I really think it's been exceptionally dry, and it is cumulative. It's been over the last year.
Yes, I think we're all concerned about, you know, the whilst we do have, you know, swings in temperatures and swings in weather patterns. And whilst we know that the G20s and climate change conference is happening out, that in the other part of the world, I'm not too sure how much of that agreements will be put into place, whether that would happen, because we have the superpowers saying some of them in agreement, some not. So those are some of the huge challenges facing us as we move, as we're moving and we find that, climate change is a reality, and we've got to understand that many are saying, well, fine, this is not happening, and, these are just normal weather patterns, and I'm not sure about that.
I'm not sure about that either. In fact, in Australia, they have had huge problems. Apart from the barrier reef dying, which is also partly responsible to warmer sea warmer sea temperatures, are partly responsible for that. And obviously, the hotter the air is, the hotter the sea is. They're also having the most severe heat waves that they've ever had. And last summer, they had a heat wave where it got so hot that birds were dying of the heat and falling out of the trees in the city. There were dead bees and bats, birds and bats all over the place. It was in the news. And a professor there has been tracking these heat waves, and he says they're becoming progressively more severe and progressively more frequent, and they are changing the face of agriculture in Australia, where farmers are now going to have to start thinking, because they all suffer, including the animal producing guys. They all suffer, their production goes through the floor, and they lose them. Even the animal producing guys are losing animals because of these incredibly intense heat waves that are every year a new record breaker. So I think this is the kind of thing we really have to take seriously and realize it's immediate.
Yes, I think that's so important. And while we're talking about climate change and, the G20 is there, they're debating these issues, and we have the United States, and we have China, and we have lots of the other countries, some of them not coming onto the, coming to the table. But talking about temperatures, I was looking at the weather patterns, and you find that, the whole of the East, Middle East and up, were in temperatures of about 45 and plus. So that is extreme when you talk about 45, 50, and you find that, the intensity increases and it becomes a huge challenge.
Yeah, no, and it is frightening. And then, of course, as soon as it gets that hot, people start running their air conditioners a lot, and then we're using still a lot of energy from coal-fired power stations. I really do support renewables. At the moment, we don't have better solutions other than solar and wind, but they are becoming extremely efficient compared to what they were a decade ago. And I'm really hoping to see our own government in South Africa also turning more towards renewable energy, because we are an ideal solar country.
Definitely. We're going to go for a short break. When we come back, we'll continue. Thanks, Andrea. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We've just tuned in. My name is Ismail Riava, and you could join our conversation this morning. We're talking to Andrea about different things in that part of the world that is out in the Southern Cape. We're talking about the devastation of the fire, water restrictions, and weather patterns. And the number to dial this morning, 854-1548, and we're looking at July in the Garden. Andrea, thank you very much for being with us. It's July in the Garden. Now, in the old days, it used to be a time when people used to sit back and say, we'll wait for another 2 months before we get into the garden. But these days, it's no longer so. And we find people are doing lots and lots of things in the garden. There's lots to be gardening with. And it's also a time to perhaps sit back, to transform your garden to a restful place, a place for reflection, rejuvenation, trying to see what has gone wrong the previous season. How can you get the best out of your garden? Is that right?
I absolutely agree with you. You also have to bear in mind, our winter weather is actually a lot like the spring weather in the colder parts of the world. This is where they all go, yeah, it's time to plant. In many parts of our country, our winters are not very severe. And it's just a little bit cooler. And that actually makes it a great time to establish new plants, because, and we're coming back to the water, you don't have to water them as much, because now it's cooler, you've got less evaporation, and the plants can actually start settling in. Very, very few places in our country where the ground actually freezes. And that is the main sort of obstacle towards gardening in the West, the old world and so on. Where we get a lot of our gardening ideas from, including our ideas about seasonality for some reason, we then might come from a country where our ancestors might come, because mine are far back, might come from a country with very cold winters, and then they bring this sort of gardening culture. It's still very much, I think we need to break away from the whole Western gardening aesthetic and the Western gardening philosophy, because it's not suitable for where we live. I mean, we have a completely different climate. Example being, for example, the middle of their winter, obviously they can't do anything, there's snow on the ground. Whereas in most parts of the country, we actually have quite favorable growing conditions at this time of the year. And some plants are frost tolerant and won't even mind if you get frost. And then you get the advantage, of course, of not having to water as much, which means you have a better chance of gardening success. Unless your person has got an irrigation system, and if you do have one, please don't have it on a timer, even if you are in an area without water restrictions, because people with irrigation systems tend to overwater. But in general, those of us who are trying to conserve water will be watering by hand or watering with a hose pipe, and so on. And it's all too easy to underwater in the very, very hot weather. And then you actually lose plants. So I think this is not a bad time. Of course, there are plants that are taking strain at this time of the year, and it does depend on the area in which you live. But certainly the areas that get light frost, there's nothing to stop them. And even in the places with heavier frost, it really just depends on what you do. And the garden centers in your areas are going to be stocking the kind of things that can be worked with at this time of year. And you yourself can see with your own eyes when you go looking for plants if anything is looking stressed out because of the weather. So you can get a pretty fair idea, I mean, just by browsing the nursery floor. And even dormant plants, you know, deciduous trees and things, fabulous time still to plant them. They can start getting their roots into the ground before they have to sprout. And they'll give you much better growth come the spring, summer growing season because their roots are now stronger. That's a fabulous time of the year. Actually, I love it. It's not brutally hot in the garden, you know. You can actually go and garden in quite pleasant, mild sunshine, which is lovely. And it gets you outdoors on a sunny day. I'm really getting more into my garden at this time of the year. And I know that by midsummer, I'm going to be hiding in the shade.
Definitely.
So this is the time to get things done. And then, of course, a smart gardener actually thinks 1 to 2 seasons ahead. So, you know, if you're going to try and get a pretty spring garden by planting in spring, you're not going to have established plants. The clever gardener will go, well, what should I be planting in autumn or winter in order to flower in spring and then be very well established? And so many marvelous plants that one can actually work with perennials as well as annuals at this time of the year.
You know, just talking about the winter, and I must say to you that whilst I look at the tree, I sometimes find the stark beauty in some of these trees without the leaves, and you find that whilst it's dormant, it has a beauty of its own. When you look at it, and sometimes when you look at it against, you know, a backdrop of perhaps a cloudy day or a sunny day, each time it gives you just a different picture. Is that correct?
You know, I love, the one example of a tree, the deciduous tree that is really to me striking is the white stinkwood, which occurs a lot in your part of the world. And it has obviously this whitish bark. And it actually stands out stark and very structural in winter, gorgeous. And then when the spring comes, it's as if the green mist is creeping over them as little buds start to pop and turn green and whatever. And it develops. It's exciting to watch. When I was a child, it used to excite me so much to see where these stark white trees suddenly get this green haze. And then it spreads and develops and grows. And suddenly, whoa, you've got trees with a full canopy of leaves. I think it's beautiful. I think gardens should change with the seasons. And that is one of the most dramatic ways to do it.
You know, just looking at what has come out of Chelsea this year, and I found some of the some you know, really inspirational things that we could do in our gardens almost immediately. One of the things that they did speak about at Chelsea was that, you know, it should appeal to the five senses, and you know that, you know, and show how plants and other design aspects of the garden can delight one's sense of taste, touch, smell, sight, and appreciation of sound. And this is an ideal time to look at it, you know, instead of find how can I, you know, sort of appeal to all the senses once I've been doing it. Perhaps it's just been visual and say aesthetic, but how can I get some lovely, you know, fragrance into the garden? How can I get some sound, you know, rustling? So there's a lot of things that you could do, and that was one of the trends that came out of Chelsea this year. What do you think about?
I think that's very profound. I think that's very profound. You know, I think we need to be very mindful if we want to enjoy the wonderful things that are on this earth and that are part of nature. And mindfulness means being aware of all your senses. You know, you hear the bird song, you hear the rustling leaves, you smell the flowers and also the leaves. I think aromatic plants with scented leaves are often overlooked. You know, you see the flowers and you touch. There are some fabulous, fabulous textures. And even visual texture also has an influence on us. But, you know, when I think of soft textures, there's lamb's ear, which is a gorgeous, soft, woolly plant. There's an indigenous pelargonium with a minty smell, and called pelargonium tomentosum, I think. And it is velvety, velvety leaves, plus the minty fragrance. And when I was working in the nursery, I would pick a leaf and rub it on my face. That's how soft and velvety it was. And then I would smell it. And because I had now very lightly disturbed it with this smoke in my face, it would smell this lovely fresh mint scent. There's so much enjoyment we can get beyond just visual enjoyment out of our garden and out of nature.
You know, the other thing that I, you know, normally do is when people do come in, sometimes make them taste some of the plants. And, you know, it's just a fabulous experience because many of them don't understand. You know, look, well, fine, it just looks like an ordinary grass. I mean, it's got a licorice stem to it. It's got, you know, the stevia, whatever plant you have. And that also gives them such joy to be able to understand that you could just, not only visually, but you could even taste some of the plants.
Oh, yes, that's true. I was just recently writing an article on indigenous herbs, for example. And I know I always come back to indigenous, but it is my favorite. I'm not a purist. I still love some of my exotics. But, there are a lot of culinary plants that we don't even think of as being culinary plants. And we can actually go and taste it and see for ourselves how we want to use it in cooking. The pelargonium is a fabulous example because of their wide range of different aromas. The buchu, there's much more than just one species of buchu. There are many, many, many buchus. And they are, without exception, very aromatic. And they each have unique smells and flavors. Aniseed, garlic, extremely strong flavors. If you're using it as a culinary herb, use it very lightly. There's sort of a lemony one, and some of them just smell spicy. It's hard to put your finger on it. So, yeah, there are so many things that we can taste in our garden that we don't even, not even really aware of the fact that we can even eat them. Obviously, you know, you don't want to be too experimental, but you can always find out there's a lot of information out. The internet is a wonderful thing.
Yes, and that's what they said at, you know, the gardens and, you know, at Chelsea, this, you can, you know, include a number, not just ordinary herbs, but herbs with medicinal uses. You know, so, and there's lots of others you could use for distillation of non-alcoholic beverages. So there's lots of, you know, herbs that you could use, and they're encouraging, and we find that the trend continues.
Absolutely, and a lot of the plants that we think of as being ornamentals can be used as herbs. So it's worth doing some research on the plants that are in your garden. If you're not sure what they are, your garden centre has helpful staff who will not like you. I remember when I was a student, people used to come and ask me a lot of questions I couldn't answer, and then I would always tell them I will go and find out immediately, which I would then do. And it was a great way of learning. So, the best way to learn is to ask questions and pop on down to your local garden centre, take a sprig of... Look, if they can't identify, they're going to tell you the truth that we don't know. It's impossible to know everything there is to know about plants. But, you know, they can tell you a bit more about the plant. Even if they only give you a name, that's a lead that you can then go into and investigate and explore and find out more about the plants in your garden and what you can actually do with them.
That's so true, you know, so don't always just take a chance. If you're not too sure, don't just put something into your mouth, pop it into your mouth, make sure that you've checked it out, and once you certain it is something that you can ingest, and that's the right thing to do. Another thing that also intrigued me was something about, you know, insect hotels, and this become more and more popular. So, you know, creating a haven for insects in your garden. Well, the term now is insect hotels, and I've been, you know, following that trend for the last 2 or 3 years, and it seems more popular that, you know, gardeners are now incorporating this so that you have wildlife come into your garden. So we're talking about butterflies, bees, dragonflies, and so forth, and they have a home in there, and it's also good for your garden.
Well, yes, you know, not all insects are pests. We tend to think of them that way because when you think of insects, the first things that spring to mind are flies, ants, and things like that. But the majority of insects are not really your enemies. And there's a lot of predatory insects. And if you can get a natural balance going in your garden, so I've never actually heard of these insect hotels. I must actually look it up. But yes, insects, you do get insects that eat the plants, and then you also get insects that prey on those insects. And then you also have birds that prey on them as well. The one nursery I worked, we had a huge area with daylilies. And I remember I was a student then. They were full of aphids. And I went to my boss and I went, oh, boss, this is terrible. The full of agents. And she said, give it a couple of days and go and look again. And I did that, and they were all gone. It was the bird. The bird had actually just destroyed all or most of the aphids. And that was her philosophy. Some people wouldn't subscribe to it. But because she kept that natural balance and she didn't put poison out, there were all these predatory insects, there were birds, and things sort of kept themselves clean, which is it's a tricky situation to do, but that's the way to do it. When I was growing berries, we used predatory mites. Because spider mite, red spider mite, which I'm sure a lot of gardeners will be familiar with, the huge problem with berries, that you cannot spray berries. They really accumulate and concentrate anything you put on them. You have to grow them organically. So basically we used to use these predatory mites. Now, these were naturally on the worst infested plant on the farm. So what we would do is when we find a new infestation, we would then take a leaf. We used to look at it under magnification. The predatory mite move much faster, mean and lean, and the grazing mites are much smaller. And we'd look for the right ratio of predators to prey, and then we would select those leaves and go and place them on top of the plants that are just starting to show signs of red spider mite, and immediately colonize them with mites, both predatory and feeding mites. But as soon as you have a lot of feeding mites, predatory mites multiply. They then feed on the feeding mites. The feeding mites become less. The predatory mites begin to die down because there isn't enough food for them. Then the grazing mites will now start to multiply because there are fewer predators. And now the predators can go, oh yeah, well, no, this population can support more of us. And they then become more. So it's this constant balance that you strive to achieve when you're working with organic. And it does mean that you do allow some insect damage, because without prey, you cannot have predators.
Thank you very much for that. And, you know, also high on the list was food security, very, very much. And we know that whilst in our own country, we know of the economic crunch and so forth, and everybody's looking at how could we perhaps grow some of our own foods. That's the one, that's perhaps the one incentive. The other one is also that we know that there's been a lot of, concern about what gets sprayed on crops. And yesterday I was looking at some of the things that's coming at Monsanto is, you know, challenging, some of the findings about certain sprays that are being used, which are the, there's research showing that may lead to cancers and so forth. And so people are now wanting to plant their own food, and food security is very high on the list. What have you to say on that?
Sorry, what was the last 2 words there?
And how can we help with food security? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, any vegetables or foods, other foods that you grow in your own garden are much more environment friendly and less energy intensive, if we're even going to talk about things like global warming, than anything you buy at the shops. Think about it. There's a whole supply chain before it comes to the shops. It goes from the farm, it goes to the market, it gets packaged. That's again another thing. The packaging industry is a big polluter. Moving more towards recyclables, but not all there yet. Then you drive to the shops, okay, the spending carbon and money. You get to the shops, you buy this, you take it home. So it's just, that food has a huge carbon footprint, and that's even fairly locally grown produce. And there's a big move towards favoring locally grown produce, because it has, even despite that carbon footprint, it has a smaller carbon footprint than something that's imported from, another country in the world that has to now be flown here or shipped with a large ship or so on. So yes, any food that you grow at home is really not only going to help with food security, but also help to fight global warming. And then also you do have the security of knowing exactly what has been sprayed on crops. Now the thing is, the way that food is sold, there is such a thing as the acceptable residue level. Now some people might argue that acceptable residue is okay, because it's too small to be a problem for your body to deal with. And others will say that any residue is a disaster. That's to a large degree personal opinion. But there are researchers there that are also very concerned, because the findings that they have discovered, that although maybe that trace amount of pesticide in that specific food won't do anything to you on its own, if it were to be mixed with, say, another trace amount of another pesticide in another food that you ate, and another one in another feed you ate, you might even get toxic reaction, because you could get a synergy between these things that actually makes them stronger than they would be on their own. There was a Swedish family that participated in a study. They ate normal supermarket food, and then they went for tests, and 52 different residues were found. They then went on to organic produce, and at the end of that, there were no residues. And they were just, the researchers say that, well, you know, the main concern there is that 52 different residues are potentially interacting, and we don't know what they would actually do when mixed together. You would normally not want to put them together because they might fight each other or they might become more toxic. So that was very much of concern. And one of our big problems with organic vegetables is that, as I said, there is always a level of insect damage. And we have this sort of weird perfectionist thing. You know, we don't want a spot on the skin of an orange, no matter how nice the flesh is underneath. We don't want to see a nibble mark or anything like that. But we should actually be looking for those things, because that means that that plant was healthily grown. And of course, anything that you've got in your own garden, you have 100% under control. Because now, although most ethical farmers will be careful about residue levels and so on, say it's the day before harvest, and you suddenly discover, oh my goodness, I've got pests. The temptation to spray rather than just dump your harvest, that's really huge.
I think it's so important. So, you know, when we're looking at foods, we don't, and what you said is so correct. We're always looking for that perfect tomato. We're always looking for that perfect fruit or perfect vegetable that looks correct, that looks, you know, to the eye very pleasing. But like you said, if we looked at it and we saw some spot or some mark or some blemish on it, I would say that it's gone through a process, and that's perhaps the one that we should be taking. But again, I think I don't know what it is. It's perhaps something that we've been fed up by the media. We should all be looking for something that's looking perfect. So all the tomatoes should be look same, round, same, you know, that type of thing. And I think that is some concern.
Very much so. And the other thing that we need to remember is when we grow vegetables in our garden, apart from pest damage, we can see things that, like a carrot with two roots, splits at the top. Now, commercially, that could never be sold. There is an enormous amount of food waste around the world. It's actually saying we could feed most of the hungry people in the world if we stop throwing away imperfect fruit and veg that, get graded out on the farms, graded out the packaged sheds, graded out in the supermarkets, because people don't want to buy this weird, unusual-looking food. That is of concern. I mean, we could be feeding the hungry of planet potentially if we just weren't so fussy with our eyes.
Well, I think those are so important. It's a good watch point. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. And just one or two other things from Chelsea again. They were looking at bowl structures. So gardens should have bowl structures and talk about features. And that's still very much, you know, so that wow factor is still there. You know, that there's a pertinent focal point when you come into a garden. And you say, wow, that is something. And, many of us would say, but what should we do as a focal point? What can we use? And there's so many plants that we can use as focal points. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, and there's so many ways to tackle a focal point. You could put a stunning garden sculpture with a nice planting around it. That's part of sculpture. You could use a water feature. Or, as you say, you can just use a plant. And with a structural plant, a feature plant, you're normally looking at structure, not as much as flowers. Although very bright colour is also a focal point, it draws the eye. But if you want something permanent to give your garden wow factor, permanent wow factor, you're going to really be looking at shape a lot. So for example, your Natal Strelitzia, the big one, the Strelitzia Nicolai, I mean, that's like, boom, you're going to see it. Gorgeous big white thinkweed in your garden, going back to that particular tree because it's a favourite. It's something that's always going to be there. It's always going to look good. You don't have to keep replacing it. And then around that, you can add elements that actually lead the eye to it, that emphasize it, enhance it. It's really quite fun really working out the focal points in your garden.
Yes, I think there's so much that we can do with focal points. And like I said, sometimes something, a focal point that will take your eye towards the sky, you know, going upwards, or something that will be vertical against the wall. So there's so much that could do. Andrea, and finally, you know, we South Africa is a water-scarce country, and, you know, we realize our resources are limited. And one of the things that they make a point about is to make a sustainable choice for a more eco-friendly garden. I think that's the underlying, you know, thing that we should be, or the underlying motto that we should adopt in our gardens, that it should be sustainable choice for a more eco-friendly garden. Would that be correct?
I would absolutely agree with that. You know, sustainable gardening, that means you're going to be looking at low resource use. So you're going to look at the plants that are right for where you are. You're not going to be trying to fight nature. You're going to be working with nature. I think sustainability also in the vegetable garden is a huge contribution towards sustainability globally. I mean, if everybody were to grow their own foods, even if they don't grow everything they eat, that would be very difficult. But everything that you do grow out of there is an extra something for the planet as well as for you yourself. So yes, sustainable gardening is the way to go. It's huge at the moment. You will find a lot of advice and information out there. As I say, pop on down to your local garden center. The staff there will also be very interested, because I think, you know, horticulture is definitely going sustainable, has been for decades, and all the more so even now.
Yes, and when looking again, you know, the two watch points would be indigenous and endemic. You know, plants that would be growing in your area or in your country, and then endemic, perhaps those that grow closer to your home. Would that be two watch points?
I think they're two very good places to start. I really get annoyed sometimes because, yeah, but that grows in itself. Why would I want to grow it in my garden? Well, you know, with your garden design, you're going to make that plant look so much nicer in your garden because you're going to put it in the right setting, you're going to look after it, and why be out of place in your environment? Blend in, make it better, be part of the environment, but even better. So that's a good place to start. However, I'm not a purist. Yes, there are exotic plants that will do very well in your area, and they're not invasive, and they have benefits for you, and they are not, you know, drought sensitive and so on. The suitable plants for your area. I think that I would say definitely suitability is probably the broadest definition. Although indigenous and endemic, obviously fabulous, fantastic, and the wildlife's going to love it. However, there are exotics that they will also enjoy. So you don't have to be a purist. But I think the important thing is to look for what is right for your environment. What is going to be able to grow without you having to beg it to grow? Because when you beg plants to grow, you normally have to spend money, time, and quite possibly buy things like fertilizers from the petrochemical industries and so on, which is also not really sustainable. But that's the way to go. Yes, definitely.
And one final question, you know, I've got a friend of mine who came and said to me the other day, you know what, I've got some of my peach trees are going to bloom, what do I do? So I said, please do not, you know, prune, is that correct?
I think once they're blooming, you really, really need to leave them alone. I'm not an expert on fruit trees, but as far as I know, anything you want to do to them, you do to them when they are dormant.
Yes.
And once they've started to go, leave it till next year.
Well, thank you very much, Andrea. You take care. Everything of the best. Thanks for being with us on the program. And we're definitely going to chat to you about indigenous plants. I know they've got so much to share with us, so much that you can tell us about. And you talk about indigenous herbs. I think that would make a fantastic program. So chat to you in the future. You take care. Everything of the best.
Everything of the best. And have a lovely day.
Thank you, Malin. Bye-bye. And that was Andrea from Southern Cape giving us some wonderful advice and telling us what's happened out in that part of the world. And that's all for me until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.